thing we all need to do across the state is get people on the grassroots level in every county, big counties to small, go to your county officials and let them know how concerning these machines are. Maybe some more county grassroots town hall meeting type things. The thing that happened in Center County was a wonderful thing. We had a meeting with the citizens in Center County back in late 2005.
This is the Rob Call Bottom Up Radio Show, WNJC 1360, Progressive Liberal Talk Radio. The news you need to know that you don't get anywhere else.
Okay, and welcome to another Rob Call Bottom Up Radio Show. It's got a great interview coming up after the first 10 or 12 minutes of the show with William Grider, who's got a new book out. And William Grider is the Washington politics editor for The Nation. And, God, he's got a breadth of experience that's incredible. And we had a great conversation, which is pre-recorded. And I'm just going to do a little intro tonight, and then we'll head right into that. So, the Rob Call Bottom Up Radio Show is supported by opednews.com, www.opednews.com. And that's a website that has basically been created for liberals who are not happy with mainstream media. But the funny thing is that we get a decent amount of Republicans who are not happy with the way things are going, libertarians, independents, and it's grown so that now around the world we see about 500,000 unique visitors a month. And I hope you'll try it out and check it out. It's a website that a lot of people say is a we the people website, because you don't have to be a famous person to write for it. We have famous people, and we've got incredible writers, but if you write and you've got a good idea and you can communicate it, we'll publish it. This week, what's been interesting is a lot of coverage of what's happening with food and farming. It got interesting. One of our writers, Lynn Cohen Cole from Atlanta, was writing up a storm, at least 60 or 70 or 80 articles about problems with new legislation that's coming down the pike that she believes is going to destroy the small family farmer and farmers' markets, and really change the way that food is treated in America and the world, really, because what happens is America tends to try to evangelize their rules and regulations so other countries will develop them too. The FDA does the same kind of thing. They try to get other countries to take the same policies. Fortunately, other countries don't, because our rules and regulatory systems are so dedicated to protecting and supporting corporations rather than people that they're nearly not very good. And that's what's happening with the rules and regulations for food. And what Lynn and other writers are saying is that even though it doesn't have its name on it, it's got its fingerprints all over, metaphorically, this legislation. And that's the company Monsanto. Now, when I bring up Monsanto to liberals, the words that come up are like evil, murdering, criminal. Now, this is what the responses I get. It's not what I'm saying. I have to be careful about this, because what got really interesting is on opednews.com last week, one of the leading people, maybe the head of publicity for Monsanto Corporation, started posting comments and even submitting some articles. And we let it happen because we wanted to have a conversation with them. We wanted to see what they had to say. And we wanted to give them a chance to respond to Lynn, because the new media is not just printing a newspaper and there it is, you look at it. The new media online is about, we publish an article and then you, the people, comment on it and add to it or disagree with it or whatever you want to say there. That's the future of the medium. The newspaper is dying, but, you know, so did the horse and buggy. You know, what's coming is better. So it's been a very interesting week in terms of that. I did a poll asking whether or not we should allow Monsanto to post articles. The majority of people, I think it was somewhere around 56 or 57% to 35% of the respondents said no, don't let them, that it's propaganda, and they can pay to put propaganda where they want to get it, that it's the site doesn't need to do that. There was general agreement that they should be able to comment and respond to articles critical of them, though. So then I did a piece with this idea that I've been playing with for a while now. The idea, you know, this week in the news, the big deal has been AIG and the salary bonuses that they gave out. And on Op-Ed News, it's been Monsanto. There was also news this week about Exxon. Greg Palast did a nice article on Exxon talking about how they never delivered on their promises to compensate people who were damaged by the Exxon Valdez spill years ago. Then you have Enron, and you have Dow Chemical, which had that horrible disaster in India where hundreds were killed. You have the mainstream media, which a lot of us blame for a lot of the problems we have for their failure to do their job. There are a lot of companies out there, specific corporations, and then there are whole industries, the pharmaceutical industry, big agriculture, mainstream media. There's Blackwater Corporation, Halliburton, and KBR. These are companies that have a reputation for being bad, bad for humanity, bad for America, bad for the people. They're good for a small group of investors, perhaps. But I have this idea that just like there is a Madame Tussauds Museum of Horrors, there ought to be a museum of the most evil companies. Maybe make it a museum of companies and have the worst companies and the best companies, although I fear that with lobbyists that mission might be damaged. It may be best to just do the monster stories. And they could show pictures and pieces and parts of the toxic waste that was spewed and destroyed. They could have videos showing stories of the lives that were ruined by the Enron fraud. They could have stories and videos showing the people who were killed by Blackwater guards who were a little too enthusiastic. This is Rob Call, Bottom Up Radio, WNJC 1360. I'm talking about a world where there's a lot going wrong, and now's the time when we can really fix it. I look at what's going on with Obama and his sales pitch to us, and there's a lot of it I'm not happy with. I don't think he's doing what he said he would do. You know, I took my show as the Bottom Up Radio show, and Obama helped to inspire that vision. But his idea of bottom-up is just not working. He's blowing it. It's not bottom-up. It's big-time money going to big-time organizations, and it's being thrown away. If he did bottom-up stuff, literally giving out coupons to people so they could go to those big companies and those companies could get the money with the people, brought them the coupons, that would be bottom-up. That would help people, and it would help the companies. And it would force the companies to use the money. That makes sense to me. Now, last fall, I talked about how the way that the automobile industry should be helped is that people should be given coupons and they should be helped out that way. Guess what? They're doing that. Why can't they do that with the banks? How many hundreds of billions of dollars do they have to give away before they screw this up royally and have to start over again? I'll tell you part of the problem. You got too many people who were part of the problem now trying to be part of the solution. like Timothy Geithner, for example. No way. The guy was a part of the problem. We have so many really smart Nobel Prize winning economists who could be going in there and doing a job that is necessary. And the job that's necessary is to start over again, is to look at this system that we have that is incredibly broken, that is built upon ideas and theories of free trade and capitalism, the Milton Friedman garbage capitalism that is a total failure. And what we need to do is throw that out with the garbage, throw it out with the bad debt, but also let the people suffer who gambled on that bad debt. Let them lose. Don't make we the people pay for it. And then what we need to do is come back with some new models, some visions of a future that are more realistic, that are based on what actually happens in the world, the way the world really works. Not these theoretical models that only work by stomping on the little guy, by destroying the middle class. Believe me, I'm a small business owner. I have several businesses. I'm all for business. What I'm not for is mega businesses built by combining tens or hundreds of businesses together, getting rid of competition, influencing government regulations so that they have unfair advantages. That doesn't work, and it's got to stop. We've got a new world now, a world where things are really rough, and they're going to get a lot rougher. We've seen a couple good days on the stock market. It's going to go the other direction. It dropped 90 today. It's going to see the other side of 6,000. I have no doubt about it. But there's some hope. Things are going to be a little better with Obama, but he needs a lot of pushing. And now, with these blue dog Democrats who act like Republicans in the Senate and the House, they got to be cleaned out. We need progressives. I would love to see progressive Republicans. I like Ron Paul. I don't agree with a lot of what he says, but the guy has a lot of ideas that are brilliant. I think we're coming up on the time now for the beginning of the interview. So, if our producer there can click it. 9:12? Oh, okay, we got two more minutes. So, you've been listening to Rob Call. That's me. Bottom Up Radio Show on WNJC 1360. We're sponsored by www.opednews.com. That's opednews.com. Check it out. Beware, it can be addicting. It's 150 articles and diaries and links a day of the latest that's going on with ideas that you're not going to see in your local paper. So, get out there and do something. Don't sit home. Don't expect someone else to do it. You be the change that you want to see happening. That's what Gandhi said. Be the change you want to see. Do it. Okay. Go for it. Thanks, and see you next week.
You're here on the Rob Call Bottom Up Radio Show, and I'm thrilled to chat with you here. You've got a new book out.
Yeah. Come Home America.
Come Home America, The Rise and Fall and Redeeming Promise of Our Country. And it's a hopeful book.
I'm trying to be hopeful for people and show them that there's a brighter future over the horizon. Not yet, but coming.
Yes, because at the same time, you're willing and able to very clearly and explicitly look at the problems we're facing as well. What do you think the message of this book is? What do you want to get across?
There are two or three layers to it, but the core is this. The country's in deeper trouble than most people fully realize, and it's beyond the financial crisis and the recession. It's deep, deep changes which are bearing down on us. And we can deal with that. But we're not going to do it successfully, in my view, if people don't step up and really rather aggressively reclaim their role as citizens.
Which people?
And everybody. I mean, and obviously everybody is not going to do that, but it's not directed at Republicans or Democrats or liberals or conservatives or working class or rich people. One of the things, the fundamental thing that I think took us off the rails in this country is the deterioration of democracy, representative democracy in the last 25, 30 years. And the elites got further and further distanced from the broad reality of how people live and what they want in their lives and what they think makes sense for the country, all of that. And if you look at individual pieces of what our adversities are, you see that same pattern.
What pattern is that?
The pattern is that you have in governing circles. Again, this is not a partisan complaint. They are drawn to perspectives and convictions that are out of sync with what people at large want. And I'm not suggesting there's unanimity among people at large. Of course not. But people at the top don't see very clearly what's down below. And this latest episode with the outrage over AIG that's being kept on life support by the taxpayers suddenly handing out million-dollar bonuses is a good example. The people in the government said, these are contracts. We have no choice. Well, wait a minute. You have lots of choices. And the public just exploded.
I think one thing you're saying that I think, you know, I do this radio show and I publish opednews.com. Are you familiar with opednews.com, by the way?
No, I'm not. Tell me.
Oh, but you got to check it out. We've grown so that we're routinely within the top 10 progressive media sites in the country.
And excellent. We
publish about 1,500 articles a month.
Opednews.com, one word.
OpEdNews.com. It's also the sponsor of this radio show.
Uh-huh. Great.
But our readers tend to be left, I think, further left than The Nation or Daily Kos. And a lot of them say that it's hard for them to tell a difference between the Republicans and the Democrats in Congress because they're not siding with the people. They're not really protecting them. And that's exactly what I hear you saying.
That's my perspective. I'll just add this definition. Because people, you want them to understand what you're saying. There are important differences between the two parties.
And I agree.
We know what they are. Or we hear them all the time. But fundamentally, on the big stuff that shapes the economy and shapes the society, those two parties have cooperated and colluded over many years.
Yeah, so you've got these monsters. You've got these monsters walking around, stomping on houses, destroying cities. Some of them poop in the middle of the town. Some of them poop in a reservoir. You know, and some
and those
latrine. Democrats are the ones that poop in the latrine, but either ones of them are all stomping all over the place.
I'm not going to go where you are, but that's okay. That's all right. I'm also not hanging up. The fact is, and you understand, I've been around Washington for a long time, too long maybe, but I know because I saw it happening. Those conditions, the concentration of power, the free run of the financial titans and all the rest, all of those things were authorized by both Democrats and Republicans.
Yeah.
And so that's one of our difficulties now. The people in Congress and around the Congress, the in and out of, when I say governing elites, I don't mean just elected people. I mean the people, everybody from lobbyists to CEOs who also drive public policy. They're all implicated in creating this mess, and they know it. So they are now scrambling, trying to stay out of the crosshairs of public anger. And they're doing, things that are, they didn't imagine a year or two or 5 years ago they would ever touch because they're so scared.
Like what?
This is good. Well, like this legislation they ripped through in 2 days to take back the bonuses the AIG guys had paid.
Yeah, this is just the push to give them the bonuses.
Right. They didn't. Well, they recall last September they approved this boodle. I called it a swindle at the time, and I think my word is not an exaggeration, to deliver hundreds of billions to save, restore these failing financial firms, big banks, etc. And they neglected to write a law that would say, we're giving you the money, here's what we demand in return, and if you're not willing to comply with these rules, you don't get the money, and you're doomed. Take your choice, right? And that this is just old-fashioned, honest legislation. They didn't do that. So now, not surprisingly, they're being burned as the bankers and others reach for more and hand it out and do all the things they do by nature.
So they basically engaged in legislative malpractice, not doing the job of looking for accountability and oversight
right.
the way they
right.
should have.
And you could see that instantly if you looked at the bill. I mean, just read the words, with any experienced person would see this is not a law. These are just sort of, it's a wish list designed to pacify the public.
Yeah.
And so that all of the leaders in Congress, Democrats and Republicans, went out and said, oh, we've taken care of that. We wrote that into the law. Well,
you know, I'm a small businessman. I've been an entrepreneur most of my adult life.
Yeah.
And I'm no lawyer, but I've paid enough lawyers to do contracts for me that I know that one thing a lawyer always does is protect the party in signing in the agreement.
That's
now,
right.
Most of these legislators are lawyers. What happened to them? Did part of their brain melt? I mean,
well,
unbelievable.
This is a habit that's been successful for them. You know, people tend to do
brain
what
melt?
Succeeds for them, and it works over and over again. So for many years, they have recognized that the way to balance between the moneyed interest, whom they want to represent and please, who finance their campaigns, and the broad, unwashed public, is to write what I called years ago hollow laws.
Kind of like budgets with holes in them.
Yeah, and you do that. This is not an accident. It's done quite deliberately in the process. You're going to pass a law to get serious about environmental protection. Don't dump this stuff in the river anymore.
So it's all for
and then the lobbyists come around, and the lobbyists understand that public opinion is so strong they are going to pass such a law, but they suggest to the staffers and to the members of the House or Senate, well, while you're passing it, will you put in this paragraph? and that's the trap door, right, which allows the corporation to agree, yes, we'll follow that, but not yet, right? And there'll be all kinds of legal gimmicks.
So this happened last week. Chris Dodd said, oh, no, I can't understand how this happened. And then a day later, CNN nailed him, busted him, and he's going, and he's trying to make excuses where he basically just lied. And what he did was he sold us out, apparently at the behest of the Obama administration and the Treasury, so they all sold us out.
But
Dodd got busted. I mean,
well, this is going to happen a lot. And I'm trying to get this is going to upset and disappoint some of my readers, I think. But I'm not trying to line up all the villains against the wall and put on blindfolds. I am trying to say the system itself is as it is operated for many years, decades, is aligned in a way that produces these results, and yes, throw the bums out. I'm always for that, but you've got to go way deeper to make this system really change. And this is why I say, and it sounds corny, but I believe it's true. Only the people can do this. The Republican Party is not going to do it. The Democratic Party is not going to do it. Barack Obama, whom I'm a fan of, I admire, etc., but he's not going to do it. It's only the force of people in motion that will.
All right. Well, this takes me back to the name of my radio show, Bottom Up Radio.
Yeah.
Let's talk about some bottom up approaches that can make this happen. What are you talking about? We're talking bottom up now, aren't we?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think this is the other thing you have to in the department of being honest and straight with people. You have to say, democracy is hard work. It is not instantaneous gratification. It requires some patience and conviction. But if people begin to form up in different groups, and I don't care what they call themselves, I do emphasize they must maintain their independence of thought from the larger institutions of politics.
You mean Democrats and Republicans?
Yeah, I mean, I'm for being a Democrat, I'm a Democrat, or for a Republican if you choose, I don't have any problem with that. But what happens now in the system is if you sign on, either by action or by voting, you are then consigned to follow whatever that party says is respectable thought. And if you don't follow it, you get pushed over to the corner and labeled as the lunatic fringe. I've lived with this fate for quite a long time, so I'm comfortable with it, but you see what I mean?
Oh, I know all about it.
You know it better than I, maybe. I mean, but it's that process that people among themselves, you know, talking and debating to some extent, but basically sorting out their own convictions.
Well, I like you have
to, you know, they have to get to a point where they have the guts to stand there and say, I know the Democrats want to do this, and I'm telling you as a Democrat who has an independent mind that it's wrong, and I'm going to be against you, and I'm going to come after you if you go down that road.
And that you, are you talking about the member of Congress? Who are you talking about?
Both, all. I mean, wherever you can get a handle. I mean,
it's time for Democrats to speak up and talk back to their legislators and say, you're not doing enough.
Yeah, more than talk back. I mean, of course, do that. But you've got to have enough sense of organization to be able to say to that legislature, look, I want you to succeed. I'm not against you personally. But if your party takes you down this road and you vote willingly for the junk that hurts us, ultimately, we will come after you. And maybe you're invulnerable because you're in a safe district. We'll skip over you and we'll go to your friend in the next district who's not invulnerable. And we will demonstrate to the Democratic Party that they have taken us granted so many years and that's over. I mean, I actually believe with a little internet organization and so forth, people can get a handle on this power rather quickly. It's not easy, but it can be done if they're dedicated to the goal of sort of, you know, if the Democratic Party doesn't change, we're going to change it, like that.
I think that's exactly what, you have a chapter, one of your last chapters, of the Underground River.
Yeah.
Simplest, least threatening investment any citizen can make in democratic renewal is to begin talking with other people. Where does this go?
Well, I hear I'm talking. I mean, this book, a friend of mine read the book a month or so ago, and he said, this is kind of your fireside chat with the American people, isn't it? And I said, yeah, that's good. I like that. Because I'm recognizing, of course we have diverse views and really intense differences. You know, what else is new? That's the nature of America. And of course, some people are already engaged. And, you know, maybe the listeners of your show are, maybe they, you know, they've been following this stuff closely and they're sophisticated, whatever. Most people are not. Most people have been pushed into a sort of passivity, right? Stay home and watch TV. Politics is not about you. And people know in their guts that they're not part of it. So I'm trying to talk to all of those people, and what I'm saying is, you've been treated as a small child by your political leaders for a long time. The way to get back your self-confidence and ultimately your power is to start believing in yourself. And you do that in conversation, first of all. Maybe just in the circle of your family, maybe with friends. You don't have to have an organization. You can start a little club of your own and just begin working out not how you feel about issue A, B, C that's being debated in Washington, but how you feel about your own lives the experience you have and know of how the country works. And that begins a process in which people can define themselves and their politics without having to take a script from above. That's what I'm getting. And it sounds mystical, and in a way it is, because people have within them the knowledge they need. It's not about the tricky track small print of legislation. It's about the country. And they, you know, and everybody will have different views, and that's the idea of democracy, right? So I'm trying to encourage that, because I believe personally that it works. And if you look at the history of this country, you will see that that's always been the way big change happened. That's what I call the underground river. The underground river is this impulse Americans have had from the beginning of the Republic for kind of not just self-expression, but engagement in shaping the future. And
engagement in shaping the future. So, and what that means is really just start talking to people. It's not an election time,
right?
But it's
right.
a crisis time. You have another chapter where you talk about how what we're going through right now is the economic equivalent of World War II.
Yeah.
That's pretty heavy. You know, one of the things that when I read that, what I thought about was one of the criticisms of the Bush administration was he brought us to war at a time when we were really tightly together while while the whole world was together in response to 9/11, and he threw that away, and then he didn't ask for any sacrifice from Americans when brought us to war. And I don't feel like we're being asked to sacrifice now.
No,
I don't think that there's that war mentality, and I think that that's something that needs to happen. It's almost like Pollyannish, like, you know, a couple of these right-wing pundits on Joe Scarborough and whatever got on and said, well, he's taking away our confidence. We need more confidence. And the next week, every other word out of Obama's mouth and his appointees was confident, confident. We have confidence. And the fact is, we're in a war. The U.S. is in more danger right now than it's ever been since World War II. Maybe even probably more than that. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes, I do. As you know, the book lays that out in considerable detail, and the adversities go across the board from the loss of the deterioration of our economic strength, largely because of the globalization and trade the way it works, the inequalities and the pyramid of who runs things, and all of these factors are now intensely serious because they combine in ways that are people don't yet grasp. But I think, back to Obama, he hasn't put it all on the table. And I understand why he hasn't, right? For just what you were describing. He'll be accused of being defeatist or pessimistic or all those bad words. I think he has the skill to do that. And
I agree.
Sort of raise the game for the American people and deliver the harder message that he hasn't yet been.
You know, it's really about trust. You know, the interesting thing is a week or two ago I had on the author of the book, The Speed of Trust, Stephen Covey Jr., you need trust to make things happen. Businesses
right.
need trust in order to get things done in an economic, fast way.
Yeah.
Obama needs to trust the American people. The Bush administration didn't trust anybody.
No, they were quite cynical, and I think we agree. Obama, whatever his weaknesses, is not a cynical person, particularly about the American people. He hasn't yet been able to step up and say, you know what, we got 3, 5, maybe long years, maybe longer, where we're not going to have what we used to have. And we're going to have to, you know, sort of austerity is a scary word, but something like a mild austerity. And it'll be good for the country, and that's why we're going to do it.
Well, that's the other thing you talk about in your book is a lot of you're very hopeful. I mean, you also talk about how this is really an opportunity when some great changes can take place.
Yeah, now, I think the changes are going to happen. They may be terrible changes. That's what's at stake here. And I had a piece actually in the Washington Post yesterday, Sunday Outlook section, the opinion section, which they, I hadn't been in that, I worked for that newspaper many years ago, for many years. And it essentially went at the divide we've been talking about, but also said, if the people don't stand up with Obama and demand just solutions to our dilemmas rather than business as usual, then of course politics as usual will prevail. And to me, that it boils down to that.
How do we do that? How do we make that clear to,
well,
to the media, to the members of Congress?
In a crude way, it's already started. I mean, what I said in this piece was the president is getting what he asked for, but maybe not what he had in mind. Because remember, last year, this is one of the things I loved about him, he kept saying again and again, put aside your cynicism about politics, re-engage as citizens, join me, I need you by my side. Okay, they're doing that, right? They're doing it with red-hot anger. And that's good, that's healthy. It's always the first stage. And the Congress is deeply rattled, as you can see, and struggling to figure out, okay, how do we quiet the beast, right? What kind of response do we make? And that's just the first, this is just the first act, right? And there are going to be many more acts over the next couple of years. But each stage, people will become a little more capable and more focused and able to say, no, that's not the right answer. We want this. And you see what I mean? This will, people can do this. People will, in the doing, will raise their game again and again and again. And I made the point that there's some truly, truly bad ideas circulating in the upper realms of Washington and Wall Street about how to put out the storm, right?
Such as?
Well, such as they want to give more power to the Federal Reserve to run everything.
And what do you think about
when the Federal Reserve has failed utterly in its public obligation to defend the safety and soundness of the system?
So what do we do about the Federal Reserve?
Well, I would take it out in the backyard and give it a spanking for beginning. But it's got to. Here's my view: we need something like a central bank in this country. It's a modern, complex industrial society, but it ought to be accountable, just like every other element of government, and it certainly should not be in the embrace of the bankers whom it is supposedly regulating. And that's one of the things we're seeing in this crisis. The Fed failed utterly to both to be regulators that the public could rely on, but also, in fact, it became cheerleaders for deregulation, and at the same time, it ran a monetary policy that whacked labor and working wages and let the financial sector go to the moon. I mean, and you don't have to be an expert on monetary policy to step back and say, yeah, that's what happened. So we need to thoroughly reform the Federal Reserve. I would just make it directly accountable to the elected government and get away with all this nonsense about how it's independent and somehow neutral. It's not neutral at all. And then you can give the Fed a broader power, for instance, to have relationships not just with commercial banks, but with the shadow banking community, all of the other firms and so forth that have interacted with banks and led to the incredible leverage and risk-taking and fraudulent valuations, et cetera, et cetera. This is a long subject of how to clean this up.
There are a lot of people that say take the Fed in the backyard and bury it.
No, I don't. Well, that's an emotionally pleasing idea. But that means then turning monetary policy over to the marketplace. Is that what they mean? Or do they mean simply not regulating at all? I mean, I don't find that. I understand why people feel that, and it may well be that to get to where I want to get to, even, you've got to first abolish the central bank and then create a new agency or whatever in its place.
What part of the central bank is essential, and why do we need it?
Well, ideally, the central bank works as a kind of moderating governor, like a governor in an engine, that moderates the speed or the slowdown. I mean,
and you're talking about the way that they raise or lower the interest rate.
Well, it's more than that, but yes, interest rates, they do it through interest rates, they do it through bank reserves. They have lots of tools.
I think that they have a few tools, and what's happened is because of the globalization of the economy, those tools have become less and less effective.
Well, I mostly agree with that, but the tools are still, the tools need to be recreated. I had a piece in The Nation just a week or two ago called Fixing the Fed, and I said and argued in that piece, you're not going to get a restoration of the banking system and finance until you first reform the Federal Reserve. And those reforms were about creating a new reserve system that again allows the Fed to moderate the explosions of credit and to stimulate. And this is what we need right now, is the power to stimulate through the banking system.
And how does that work? What would stimulation through the bank work?
Well, you'd have basically a liability reserves, and not just in the commercial banks, but in all those other, everything from hedge funds to pension funds and mutual funds and so forth. Their balance sheets can get a kick from the Fed as it buys assets from them, and essentially, it's complicated stuff, but it essentially then compels them to go lend, to find customers, that is, worthy customers that they can lend more capital to.
Now, you know where I've been on this? Obama, all along, for a long time, almost every day, he would talk about fixing this from the bottom up.
Yeah.
And giving banks billions of dollars is a top-down approach.
Absolutely.
I don't care if you've got 100 banks and you're each giving them $2 billion or $10 billion.
Well, but they didn't even do that. They gave it to a few banks.
Yeah. So my theory is the way to do it, if you want to force lending, is give coupons to people and businesses, make them available.
They've got to
qualify, and then the banks only get the money to lend to those people when they interact with them, and that's bottom up.
That's also
democratic.
Yeah. I like that very much, and throw in, as we reform everything under the sun, I wouldn't recommend this for the entire system, but there ought to be a piece of it that are actually public banks. They're owned by the government, or they're owned collectively by the people. And they're not going to do banking according to the usual profit-seeking rules. They're there as almost sort of like public utilities, right? People need credit. Here's a operation that using the public's trust will dispense credit at a lower price and carefully, to be sure, but maybe to interests like environmental developments, etc., that are not high in the priorities of the private system.
And student loans.
Yeah, there's a whole long list of things. Absolutely. Why should citizens, since after all the credit originates with the government anyway, why should citizens be paying market interest rates to borrow from themselves?
Well, yeah. or look at the credit card rates. They're usurious.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, it's interesting because, Charles Grassley, when they held that health care meeting that Obama put together for trying to solve the health care problem, Grassley pointed out that he was worried that if there was a public health care component, if people had access to a choice where they could get their health care from the government in some way similar to the VA or Medicare or something like that it would be difficult for businesses to compete with that.
Yes.
That would probably be the argument that would be raised.
Well, it is the argument. I mean, one of the, this is a little bit of a diversion, but one of the reasons the Republicans went after Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac was because they were essentially taking market share away from the private big banks. And that campaign was initiated not by Republican conservatives, but by the bankers. And the Democrats defended Fannie Mae because it was doing housing and had a broader, less, concentrated view of who should get loans and so forth. I mean, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac had its own outrageous qualities and deserved to be spanked, but it always comes down to that issue. Why? And you can apply it to so many things. Why is this being done privately in a profit, as profit centers, when it's actually a public function? And I might make an argument in the book that big government has gotten horribly confused because it now thinks it has to bargain with those powerful private interests in order to do something for the public. And you look around you see that pattern in everything, not just healthcare, but the cap and trade system for controlling carbon emissions is based on the same principle. And I think it's a trap, because once you get into that creation, you will find that the progress, that is raising the requirements for stopping the carbon pollution, will still be a matter of essentially begging the private interests, whether it's oil, coal, whatever, electric utilities, to change the rules. And they will say, well, we're not ready to change the rules, or it's too expensive, or one thing or another.
Well, you know, that whole expensive thing, the fact is, Robert Kennedy Jr. has talked a lot about this, how what polluters basically do is there's the expense of cleaning up their waste is one that they dump on the people as long as they can get away with it, even though it is a major expense that is basically extracted from the public in terms of cost
right. And
in terms of health.
Absolutely.
So, you know, really what it amounts to is, this is expensive and you've been getting it free ride for a long time, and the free ride is over, and now you're going to start paying for it. And if that makes what you do no longer viable, well, then we'll have to switch to something else. And that's really where
that's
I think
good.
We need to be with that.
Yeah.
Now, you know, you've got.
Let me just throw in one thought with that, Rob.
Go.
I think big chunks of the public, not everybody, but pretty widespread. People understand that kind of change has to be made, and they will not regard it as socialism or radical or anything else. They to them, it looks like common sense. The political system is a barrier, partly because politicians have been schooled, and they're not delusional. If you talk that way, the interest will come after you and whack you and cut off your money and so forth and so on. So this, again, is a reason why I think people have got to step up and create. I think people, they're doing it right now, can change the zeitgeist of politics.
Well, you know what? I was talking 2 weekends ago, I had lunch with John Conyers.
One of the great ones. Yeah.
He's one of my heroes, I'll tell you.
Yeah, me too, me
he's
too.
He's incredible. But, you know, I said to him, you know, he's sponsoring H.R. 676, the Universal Single-Payer Healthcare Bill, and I said, well, what about all the people who criticize it as socialized medicine or socialism? And he basically said, well, that's a bunch of BS. And really, you know, when I think about it, what needs to happen is when people are on the news channels and some right-wing pundit says, oh, what's socialization? The other guy's got to stand up and say, this is bull. You're full of it. This is nonsense.
Right.
Your crazy talk is like saying that the police are communists because it's socialized.
That's right.
We've got to come back 100 times harder than we have in the past. We've got to make it clear that you can't use that kind of talk anymore because it is bull.
But you know what? I'm feeling optimistic, especially right now, because I see that happening. In small strokes maybe, but those strokes add up pretty fast. And we do have the problem that many people have observed over many years, which is that the federal government itself is no longer as trustworthy as it was, say, 2 generations ago, and in fact is incompetent in lots of ways.
Well,
that didn't happen accidentally, as we know.
Absolutely.
And so now we've got to set about, you know, we've got two goals. One is just anybody who wants big change. First, you've got to convince people of the substance of what it is you say has to happen. And then secondly, you've got to look very hard-eyed at not just the federal government, because they've got a lot of good people inside, but the parties that have power over the federal government, and say, we're now going to demand a different standard from you all. You can't play these hide-and-seek games anymore, and you will be judged rather stiffly on results and so forth and so on, but concentrate on restoring the competence of the federal government to do what it's supposed to do. And I think people will react to results in very, very quickly, say, yeah, this is working. Okay, let's go, you know, like that.
Well, it's a lot of work yet. I mean, the last 8 years, the effort was to weaken government, shrink it, replace it with privatization.
Yeah.
That didn't work, and literally ignore regulations.
That's right.
And, we've got to turn around what Grover Norquist dreamed about and made happen or encouraged and was facilitated in happening. And we've got to re-governmentalize our nation, really.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because, you know, I used to think back in 2002, all through the Bush administration, how really what we need to do is we've got to reverse privatization.
Yes.
And you call that governmentalization? What do you call that? Take it back for America.
Well, it's really defending the general public welfare cannot be done in private. Everybody in private enterprise and elsewhere in the society will contribute to it or will hinder it, but that's why we have government in the first place, and that's what we're trying to reconstruct and rehabilitate. I'm old enough to know that it wasn't always this way. It's been this way for a long, long time. But when I was young, there was actually a kind of general understandings on some of the things you and I have been talking about. There wasn't radical at all.
When was that? Under what president?
50s. Well, you know, coming out of World War II, the country had a different ethos then. It was ready to get past war and enjoy life, and that's when the American middle class emerged. And Republicans, there were a few hard heads who didn't sign up for it, but Eisenhower was president.
Eisenhower warned. He's the one who came up with the military-industrial complex.
He not only that, and you know why? Because he was a great commander in World War II, and he understood that just producing stuff for the arms manufacturers was not national defense. That was not national defense, and he wouldn't go along with it. He was really, in some ways, the last president who stood up to the military-industrial complex on the big stuff.
And, do you think Obama has the potential to do that? Could he do that, or is he just...
I think it's one of those vulnerabilities which he is tiptoeing around, and here's my belief. It's really a wish. If you get a public presence, a formation that says, you know what, militarism is not good for us. It's actually dangerous, and let's start talking about how we change that and begin to pull back our risk-seeking deployments all over the world, I think you can get a discussion that brings together bleeding-heart peaceniks like myself with people in the military, or at least recently retired from the military. Because you know, during the war in Iraq, the voices that spoke up were often not just admirals and generals who were leaving the service, but people in the ranks. They were the truth tellers on a lot of stuff, and they know that this, in the end, the military institution will be injured by these sort of casual next wars. And so
I got to bring up last week on the show, I had Cody Rowley and Ray McGovern.
Mm-hmm.
And Cody is a whistleblower who worked for the FBI, who basically lost her job at a lower pay rate because of her blowing the whistle. And we talked about the fact that Obama's first signing statement basically looked like it was going to weaken the potential for legislation that protects whistleblowers. Not a good sign.
Yeah. Well, here's the other thing, and then I have to go.
Okay.
One of the myths we have to get over is the myth that magical presidents can save us. It ain't going to happen. And I say that with all respect and sympathy for Barack Obama.
Yeah, I like what you have to say about that. It makes sense. We have to do it. We have to support him, and we have to make it happen in addition to him. On the other hand, you look at what a magical president can do to mess us up.
Exactly. And he used that, didn't he, quite cynically and viciously.
Well, let's end on a note here, if you got to go. Chapter 10 is about the end of the conservative era. Tell us about that a little bit.
Well, it's a cycle that's run through history, actually, but it only happens every 30, 40 years. And we're lucky enough to be at that moment now.
A cycle?
A cycle of what you would call respectable thinking. And the economists encourage. I mean, I know this because I've read the history, but also been following it. If you reel back to a time, say in the '60s and earlier, there was an economic consensus, a consensus among professional economists about the roles of government and how things worked, and how one of the things government had to do through instruments like the Federal Reserve is stop the markets from doing widespread uncontrolled destruction, right? That was the general premise that came out of the New Deal. By the 70s, it was breaking down for good reasons, not just propaganda, because it wasn't functioning anymore, and liberals sort of lost their way, etc. They get replaced by, to make it simple, Milton Friedman and Ronald Reagan.
Ah!
And they become the icon for 25, 30 years. And Democrats resist at first, but finally throw in with them, not all of them, of course, but most of them. And so we get this, because there's no opposition party, we get all of the stuff we are now seeing the consequences of.
There's no opposition party. Is that what you just said?
There wasn't on the big stuff. No. Yes, I mean, look, the deregulation did not start with Ronald Reagan. It started in 1980. Democratic president, Democratic Congress stripped away interest rate limits and repealed the law against usury. And what do we got today? Usury. It's everywhere. It's everywhere.
It sure continued under Clinton, too, didn't it?
Absolutely. And Clinton took it a step further and with the, in collaboration with Alan Greenspan and the Fed and Robert Rubin and some others, creates the mega banks, the very banks that we're now bailing out with hundreds of billions of dollars.
And, of course, now we have all these Clinton appointees surrounding Obama, advising
who
him.
Who participated in this act of of destruction and are now trying to cover it up.
Cover it up. So you're literally, are you suggesting that they're trying to cover it up? That's a very interesting.
Well, there's nothing criminal in that. They're unwilling to come forward and acknowledge their error. And Larry Summers is the leading example of that.
Maybe they're unable. Maybe they don't get it.
Larry Summers, we're told, is a very, very bright man. I know him slightly. I mean, I've interviewed him over the years. He doesn't walk on water either, let me put it that way. But, you know, this is a process that is promising. And as I said in the book, it's a dramatic opening to history when an ideological system breaks down as the conservative market ideology has done. Our problem is that at this critical moment, the alternative is not yet formed. The Democrats are starting to take steps toward restoring their heritage, really, as a reform party that's interested in protecting working people and so forth and so on. But it's pretty obvious they ain't there yet.
Well, you know, you've talked a lot about hope in this.